Hi, I'm Irene Bakalenik, a new poet at age 95, and I've just written a book of poetry entitled Rueful Reflections, which you can see or can be purchased on Amazon.com. And I'm now doing an interview with Rabbi Saul Solomon on the radio program Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Here I sit, broken-hearted. I never remember the rest of that, but I do love poetry, and we are all in luck today, my friends, because I, Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York, will be talking to a poet, a poetess, and a Jewess. Her name is Irene Bakalenik. She spent many, many years as a theater critic, and now into her ninth decade of life, she has become a poet. She has a book out called Rueful Reflections, Book One, which is available on Amazon.com and other places. I want to talk to her about poetry, about the theater, about her life, being 95 years old, though we should all live so long. Welcome and shalom, Irene Bakalenik!
Shalom.
First of all, as you have to ask any 95-year-old person, how you feeling? How you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm feeling fine. I'm still driving.
Wow.
I really moved to a senior center because I didn't want to cook anymore. And once in a while, they attempt a good Jewish meal, but I must say they don't know how to make tzimmes.
Nobody knows how to make tzimmes. It tastes like rocks half the time. Is it a kosher? It won't be a kosher facility, is it?
No, it isn't.
Okay. Oh, well. It did happen. Now, you were married for me. Is your husband still with you?
Unfortunately, he died last year.
Oh, I'm very, very... How long were you together?
67 years.
Wait, was that 60 with a 6?
6. S-I-X.
60. Oh, my... So, let me... I hate to lead with such a sad, difficult question, but what is it like after being with someone for 6.5 decades, suddenly, like, being on your own?
Well, I'm not that much on my own. I made sure that we moved here because I didn't want to cook anymore.
Right.
And you do get your meals here, and it's a good community, and there's a lot of activities that go on, some initiated by the residents here and some by management, and it's a good place to be. And as for my husband, I found that I worked it out by writing a number of poems to him, which really helped me feel better.
Would you say that you are still in mourning, or has that period kind of passed?
That's passed. Unfortunately, I just lost my daughter, my oldest daughter, and that was much harder, frankly, because my husband was 94 years old when he died, and he'd had a good, long, I think, satisfying life.
Well, let me ask you, not to get into terrible detail about you, how do you reconcile with God when you lose a child? I can't believe I'm asking such serious questions. This is, but you know.
Right, you're asking a serious question. I'll give an honest answer, and you, the rabbi, may hang up on me. I don't know. I'd say I've been an agnostic in all my adult years, really questioning. And I found during these difficult periods, particularly losing my daughter, I kept looking for faith and writing and, you know, questions to God if you're up there, maybe.
Now, you chose poetry as the means of this expression rather than say essays or short stories. How come?
Poetry happened to me. I'd never written a poem before in my life. And we started a little workshop, a writer's group here, another woman who'd been a newspaper woman for years, and myself, and she managed to get someone she knew who was a retired creative writing professor from Queens College in New York, and she took us on. In fact, she took 5 of us on, provided we were serious about writing, and she kind of pushed me into the poetry. Other people were writing essays, poetry, short stories, and I was doing interviews, and she had no use for that at all. She didn't see that as creative writing.
Oh, well.
Sort of bullied me into it. I don't know. I sort of timidly tried it. Before I knew it, they were pouring out.
Now, is it closer to free verse, or is there rhyme schemes? Are you doing haiku? Well, how would you describe the kinds of poetry that you do?
I don't like rhymes.
Okay.
They kind of cheapen a poem. And I think, you know, that's the way of most poetry nowadays, I'd say. It doesn't rhyme. I think I'm very conscious of tempo, the rhythm, the music of a poem. That's important. And imagery, and you want to get some effective, shocking, startling images, and whatever your theme is, you want it to speak to the reader.
Now, do you have, at this point, a favorite poem of yours?
Oh, dear. 200 of them. Which one should I...
200? Wait a minute. You just started writing these, what, 2 years ago or something, and you have 200 of them?
Yes. I'm working on book two now.
Oh, my God. I mean, mazel tov. I think that's fantastic. Do you literally write like 3-4 a week?
During the time when I was writing, that was mostly last year. And I do a few now and then. But at that time, I don't know, they just poured out. It was as though they'd been waiting there for a lifetime.
Wow. Okay.
Mostly at 2 a.m., by the way.
Isn't it always, just something opens up after 1:30 in the morning?
It does.
Now, let's roll this back, because it's kind of interesting. I mean, talk about getting a late start artistically, starting at 93, 94 years old to become a poet. But everything, in some ways, was kind of late with you throughout your life. Maybe that's why you have so many years behind you now, because it took you so long to get going. Like, you went to high school, right? But you didn't go to college directly.
I know. And in those days, you did. Either growing up in Providence, Rhode Island, if I'd been lucky enough to be in New York, I might have been able to get a free college education, but not in Providence. If you were from a wealthy family, you went to college. Otherwise, for most people, it was high school and a job.
Which it was for you, but what happened?
And I'd been working as a secretary. I was in the school department in Providence. And suddenly it hit me. I was always a reader, a big reader, that why shouldn't I go to college? I don't know where I got the idea, impulse. And I asked the guidance teacher there what she thought of the idea. If she'd said, forget it, I would have just forgotten it. But she said, go up to Brown University.
Whoa.
Providence. She said, start at the top, talk to them, see what they say. So I went up to Brown University. I don't know where I got the nerve. And they said, well, you have no preparation for college. If you get tutored in algebra and French, we'll consider you conditionally. And that's what happened. They took me in conditionally. And
what was it, liberal arts, or what was your major as an undergraduate at Brown?
I majored in English literature, honors in English. I graduated, as it happened, first in the class.
Whoa! Is that valedictorian? Is that, or salutatorian? What do they call that? Summa cum something?
Summa cum laude.
So,
I have honors in English literature, yeah.
Wow. So...
I really worked. It was kind of a playboy school in those days. Although it was during the war, and when the soldiers started coming home from the war, it became a much more serious atmosphere, I think.
So, but this was before or after? Forgive me for not knowing the time frame. Was this...
1943 to 1946.
Oh, so you were in the middle of it. So at first it was more of a party school, putting the cum in, summa cum laude, and then the soldiers came in and you saw the change while you were there.
Right.
Wow. Wow, okay, so after college, and you got this degree, this summa cum laude, this degree, what did you do with it?
You would have thought I'd have brains enough to do something with it. All I knew was I wanted to get to New York. Work. I took some kind of job in the city, and I remember going up to the dean while I was a senior and saying, what am I going to do with my life? And she looked at me, because what you did with your life in those days, if you were a woman, you got married. Hopefully.
Right.
He didn't offer any suggestions career-wise.
Yeah, I guess not.
Well, as a matter of fact, I was in New York, met my husband, and did get married quickly. So I had a couple of nondescript jobs, and then had a family. And so I never did get a career off the ground at that point.
And you, at this point, you stayed with a B.A., right? Because later on, you got some more schooling.
Well, we moved to Westport with a couple of our kids. We ended up having four children.
Mazel.
And they were little, and I began to write first for as a volunteer for the League of Women Voters for the U.N. Association of Volunteer, and got a couple of little pieces into the local paper. Eventually, I started writing feature stories for a daily newspaper in the area. I remember sitting on the beach when my kids were small and writing an article.
Huh.
So I gradually got started that way.
And you were writing, well, I'm...
I went back to school because I liked studying. Not for any... I didn't have any thoughts of a career, really. But I got an M.A. at that point.
From where?
From University of Bridgeport, which was nearby.
Uh-huh.
And what should I say about that? I had no intention of being a teacher. I tried it. I didn't like it at all. But I went on writing as a freelancer.
And you were still covering basically suburban life in Bridgeport, Connecticut at that point, right?
At that point.
Now, let me tell you something. Sounds like Irene was a bit of a dabbler, a dilettante doing this. But guess who picked up your writing? Who got interested? Tell.
No, I never took the idea of a career seriously, truthfully. But I realized, looking back, the one thing I took very seriously was writing. Always, whether it was just a volunteer piece for the League of Women Voters, or an article for the local paper, or an article for the New York Times.
Ah, there you go. That's the thing. You wrote for several years, for like 5 years, regularly, for the New York Times. How did that happen?
Well, I was writing for the Bridgeport Post, and I thought, why don't I try tackling something better, and I sent a letter to the Times with several story ideas. Never heard from them. Oh, no, wait a minute. I did hear from them. They said, you could try writing something on the women's movement, which was just getting underway then in the 1970s. And I wrote a piece. I interviewed women who were starting up groups here, rap groups, organizations. And then I didn't hear from them about the article until one day a copy editor called me and asked a couple of questions about type and this and that. And I said, you mean you're using the article? He said, yeah. They never bothered to tell me. But that was my first piece in the New York Times.
And how frequently, how often were you published over the course of those 5 years in the Times?
About once a month.
All right, not too bad. Not too shabby, What was your proudest... Do you remember your proudest article that you wrote for them? Was it the first one, or was there something else?
I won a Times Award for the Publishers Award for the best short story, the best article of the month, and I guess that's the one we should think about. And that was an article on husbands raising children alone.
Huh.
That won an award. So.
All right, that's pretty darn... I mean, hey, an award for an article in the New York Times, not too shabby. How come it was only 5 years that you were with the Times?
It's a very lonely thing as a freelance writer, and I thought, oh, if I could only be on a newspaper, but my youngest kid was still only about 12 years old, and I kind of thought about that, and going into New York to work was really out of the question, I felt.
Oh, so, but why did you have to...
There was a weekly, small weekly paper in the area here, and they were looking for somebody on staff.
Oh.
Called me because I had written to them applying for a job many years before, and I went to work for them for a couple of years.
Oh, so that became
friendlier and warm and lovely. We had an editorial department, and we all, we were together on it. We worked together. We came up with story ideas together, and so that was my next step.
I hear you. Now, are we talking about, when was this, the late 80s, early, 1990s?
That would have been in the late 70s.
Oh, 70s, okay, still 70s here. And then at some point you fell in love, you were a long time in love with your husband, but you fell in love with something else. The theater!
Well, I was getting bored with writing for that little weekly newspaper, truthfully. And I thought I'd take a summer off, and I found... I had written an article about a teacher who did an exchange with a teacher in England, and I thought, why can't I do an exchange for a couple of months with a reporter in England? Well, that never worked out. And then I looked at programs they had, summer programs, and I found that Oxford had a summer program with an American school one summer, and I applied for that and went over to Oxford for a summer.
Whoa, nice.
And I happened to take, among other things, a course in British drama, just at random. And I saw so much theater in England at that time. And if you're going to fall in love with any theater, believe me, you can do it with English theater.
All right, now stop right there, Irene. Stop right, because I want to know. I'll bet you remember a bunch of the shows and the performers that you saw in that eye-opening, mind-opening, soul-expanding trip that you took to England and Oxford. So what are some of the shows you saw on the West End?
Well, the one I remember, incidentally, was... Royal Shakespeare Company performing outdoors at Regent Park. And one of my daughters happened to be over in Europe at the time. She was visiting me. And we went. We sat outdoors, bundled up under a blanket. And it's the first time I saw Shakespeare, I have to confess. I saw Midsummer Night's Dream. Until then, Shakespeare was something I read, not saw on stage. And I was just transported, really.
Wow, a good production. Do you remember who was in it or who directed it, by any chance?
No, but it was the Royal Shakespeare Company.
True. So, what about modern British drama, or did you see any American plays? What else did you see during that amazing 2 months of time?
Well, I remember I fell in love with Joe Orton's plays, if you remember Joe Orton.
Was it What the Butler Saw, or which one? Do you remember? Or
What did I like? Oh, God.
Lute? Could it have been?
Name some of the others. My memory's not.
I don't know. He didn't write that many. He died so young. But it was Lute, What the Butler Saw. Oh dear. There's one other that's kind of famous.
Up something. What was it? Up the something. Yours.
Oh, well, there you go. Up the something. That would be appropriate. Okay, but so you saw Joe Orton. Do you remember any of the performers? Did you see any legendary actors? Actresses?
Over there. A lot of West End stuff. And a lot of the, you know, the National Theater. And I went to Avon, and Oxford had its little community theater groups that I went to see.
So, having done that, you come out of that amazing little idyllic vacation, and now you know that you want to do something else. So how did you go about becoming a freelance theater critic for many years after that?
I wanted to be a theater critic, and I came back, and I applied to newspapers. I couldn't get anything. I think because it's such a, I don't know what to call it, a sinecure. Nobody wants to give it up if they're doing it. And I happened to, on the street, run into a former neighbor, somebody I knew. I was living in Westport. And I said, what are you doing these days? She said, oh, I'm getting a PhD in theater. And something clicked in me. I thought, well, why don't I just go back to school and study theater? And maybe that will qualify me. Besides, I like going to school. Anytime I have an excuse to go to school, I like it. And I applied to City University of New York in their graduate program, got in, and went through the program.
And came out with a doctorate. You are. I should call you Dr. Bakalanek. I really ought to. And did that help you get any jobs?
Well, I got interested in Jewish theater during that time. I happened to be covering, what do they call themselves? The Jewish Repertory Theater. And they were doing a Ivanov play. And I'm thinking, why is a Chekhov play appropriate for a Jewish theater? But if you remember that story, it's about a Jewish girl who marries somebody in the aristocracy out in the countryside, and nobody accepts her because she's Jewish, and he regrets that he ever married her. It was a very appropriate play for them to do. And I got so interested in that play and got interested in the Jewish Repertory Theater, and I wrote my thesis on the story of the Jewish Repertory Theater.
You know, I want to do a sidetrack here. Why do you think? Because when Dave, who is the host and producer of this program, when he first started reviewing theater, there were two Jewish theater, you know, doing English, American, and plays on Jewish themes. There was a Jewish rep in the American Jewish Theater, as well as, yeah, the waning days of the Volksbühne and little pockets of, like, the public here and there. Why do you think those both kind of petered out? And there isn't really a quote-unquote Jewish theater in New York, unless you count Volksbühne now.
Well, now and then they formed another Yiddish theater on its own when somebody disagreed with something at the Volksbühne. But the Volksbühne is still going strong. They really are, David.
Oh, I know. I'm not David. This is Rabbi Saul.
Oh, sorry.
It's easy to mistake us. We're both bald and angry most of the time. But I'm saying, like, why do you think Jewish rep and American Jewish went out and were never replaced?
In New York, well, there was an Israeli American Jewish theater that comes over from time to time. And it's not what it was. I think it was just a question of money. And people were probably more interested in mainstream theater. But across the country, you do have a strong Anglo-Jewish theater movement. You do, because I belong to the Jewish Theater Conference for years and years. And some of them are JCC theaters. Some of them are independent professional theaters.
Well, yeah, and does Theater J still exist there in Washington, or they might have morphed into something else? So, I mean, yeah, across the country, they've got a couple.
Theater J, as far as I know, are still going strong. And, oh, God, there are a number of them around the country. I've sort of dropped out of the Jewish Theater Conference, so I don't know how strong it is at this point. For years and years, they got together. They held a Jewish Theater Conference once a year, which I always covered and wrote up. I ended up writing for a Jewish newspaper, among other.
Which one?
The Jewish Post and Opinion in Indianapolis.
Wow, I have to say, I've never, I know the Jewish Press very well, and the Allgemeine Journal, but this is a new one on me. So cool. Let me ask you, Irene McElhenick, of all those years you were reviewing theater, what was the best thing, your favorite show that you saw, Jewish or not?
My favorite show? Oh, dear. I can only say every now and then you have an experience that's, you know, it's out of this world, and you understand why it all continues to exist thousands of years and why it's important to you. But I can't name one.
Or, you know, if there's a couple in your mind, pick one. Like, what's an out-of-this-world experience?
I like Sondheim's works. I like Company very much. Oh, dear. I'm not prepared to answer that.
Okay. I mean, you've been out of the theater game a little bit, you know, for a few months now.
Oh, I will tell you one. You know, you're stimulating me here. Volksbühne did a Yiddish production of Gilbert and Sullivan, Pirates of Penzance, which is absolutely hilarious, which I adored.
Oh, good. Now, here's the other side of the question. Since you had to sit through, as a theater critic, not just the things that you liked and loved, but things you didn't like, what was the worst, blurkiest thing you ever saw?
I can remember that happening from time to time, where I wanted to walk out it, but I never walked out at mid.
Wow!
Never walked out. But I can't think of one at this point. And my recent favorite was I got into New York. I haven't been getting into New York this past year, but I made it my business to get in for Hamilton.
Oh, my goodness. And what did you think?
I thought it was remarkable. One of the things I loved about it was, for years, we critics have questioned, can you have a black person playing a white role, would that work or wouldn't it work? And we were always questioning that, whether that made sense. Here it went beyond that. It no longer mattered. You know, you had a certainly racially mixed cast.
And, well, you've seen racially mixed. They've done Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with a black cast. They've done On Golden Pond on Broadway. I think you can go with it at this point. Even before Hamilton, I think people were accepting.
Have an all-black cast and decide that what you want to do is push that idea. And, of course, I saw all of August Wilson's plays at Yale Repertory Theater because Lloyd Richards was then artistic director, and he made sure that Lloyd Richards got a break and the black players got a break.
And August Wilson's plays were done there. And were they amazing? I mean, could you tell immediately, even before he became a legendary playwright, that, oh, my God, he's up there with the all-time majors?
You know, when I think about it, August Wilson. Who am I trying to think of?
Yeah, August Wilson.
Names elude me, but the South African white playwright.
Oh, Athol Fugard.
Thank you, Athol Fugard. Some of the plays he did were about black-white race relations were absolutely wonderful. I really liked that playwright.
And by the way, for people playing at home, it's A-T-H-O-L. So I know it sounds like something else, but that's how you pronounce Athol.
I know. Athol Fugard.
Now, we're talking with Irene Bacalenik about theater, about poetry, about her life. Let me ask you something, and again, it goes back to the age thing, because I don't talk to a lot of 95-year-old people. We're living in an age, we've got a recently elected president, whatever you may think of him. Do you get a head up about the world? Like, do you worry about terrorism? Do you worry about what Donald Trump may do that will affect the world, let's say in 15 years, because it really won't affect you?
Rabbi, now you're really hooking me. I've never been so politically, emotionally involved as I am now. In fact, a number of us are here, you know, making calls, pushing to block his appointments. The appointment, who was it?
Oh, well, there's Pence there, or DeVos, or...
Education one and Bannon, yeah.
So,
I did write a poem about Trump, which rhymed, by the way. It's my only rhyme poem.
Wow. I may ask you to read. Do you have that near you? We may play that if you want to. We can have you reading it to us.
I may get arrested.
That's right. If the thought police are listening into this radio program, because I know they are.
I'm walking around the apartment looking. I had a copy of that poem out. I'll read it to you, but I don't know if we should include it.
Oh, it's fine, and we, you know, don't worry if there's naughty language or anything. Go for it. I will take the hit, I promise.
We may both end up. Not my greatest poem, because I don't usually rhyme, and I found it was hard to rhyme and do a good poem at the same time. But Trump rhymes with so many things I couldn't resist.
Oh, here we go.
Here it is. It's called Trump Slump.
Okay.
He's now our leader, Mr. Trump, who slid in on fat rump. Is he a visionary, Trump? Au contraire, a nut, a chump, ruling like a blinded ump, mindless blog, a blimp, a clump. Will our country with this Trump experience a new triumph? No, we're headed for a downward bump, a trumped-up soon disastrous slump. Led madly by our Fuhrer Trump, with people marching clump, 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 each hopeless step a backward thump, while all the world becomes a dump. That's it, Rabbi.
That was actually really, really good. Yeah, I mean, we're not talking about Lord Byron here. We're talking about a political, satirical, comical poem, and that was really good. Wow. Wow. Thank you, Irene Bacalenik. You know, when politically, wherever you stand, it's always great to hear, you know, that's while we still can. While we still can criticize our elected leaders, let us do that, you know.
I thought about an assassination, but...
Whoa. We can't go there, Irene.
Yeah, all right.
No, but we can go...
I'm concerned. Of course I'm concerned for my children and grandchildren and for our country. And I find myself wondering if it gets bad enough, will a movement really evolve that has some meaning and strength to a person.
Well, it would just be another outcropping of the, like the, what was it, the Occupy movement several years ago that died down and it went into Bernie Sanders, and that died down because he didn't win. But who knows, the next outcropping of Occupy, well, we saw it the day after the election with the Women's March. So, you know.
It was really heartening to see that a Republican judge banned that,
Oh, the Muslim ban. The ban, the Muslim ban. I gotcha. I hear you.
And the Muslim ban temporarily, but that was such a good sign.
Well, it's been a great sign hearing your words, your thoughts, Irene Bakalanik. I want to remind people that they can get your book of poetry, Rueful Reflections, book one. And I have no doubt there will be a book two because you're being so prolific. But they can get that on Amazon.com. Unfortunately, all those theater reviews that you used to write, I don't know if you can still go on Backstage and find them. You used to write articles for Theater Week. God, you know, those aren't posted online anywhere, so you can't really call that up. Can people get a copy of your book? Because your dissertation, East Side Story, you said was published. Is that findable?
That was published by the University Press of America. I think if they just type in my name, all of my stuff will come up, some of the reviews and the book. That book was published by University Press of America, I don't know.
Which means that, I mean, if you do up a serious library search, a scholar would be able to find it, if not necessarily the average, quote-unquote, person, or the below-average person like myself. Last question for Irene Bakalanik. When you're writing these poems, do they just come out, and then do you sit on them? Do you edit them later? Do you struggle with them? Last year you said they were just pouring out of you. But how much editing goes into the poetry that you're writing?
Well, I found that I'm going through an editing phase. Well, not now, but while I was getting book one ready, I did do a lot of editing and weeding. I became an editor. It's much easier for me to be an editor than a writer, I think. I did do some editing. But most of them just happen the way they happen. I don't think I'm doing them anymore now. I haven't been writing recently. I'm working on book two now, so I find myself very much in an editing.
But hopefully the spigot has not clogged. I mean, once you get through editing all these other poems, you'll get new ideas and new fresh thoughts for new poems, I hope. I'm sure you will.
If I'm up at 2 a.m., I certainly will.
Do you have the book in front of you by any chance? I would love for you to go out reading us one more poem. It doesn't have to be a funny one. It can just be any poem that you choose.
I was thinking of one I'd like to read to you. It's not in book one. It's going to be in book two. But it's not too long.
Please.
Okay. And it's really how I feel about immigration, you know, when they were making all that fuss about immigration. This is called Migration. The stories of all peoples is a story of migration. For 10,000 years or more, we've swept across the globe, seeking hunting grounds or lands of milk and honey. Sanctioned by our gods, we've spread our seed, reaching Aborigines with conquest, rape, and purpose, or with more gentle unions, mixing language, sperm, and culture. Thus, we've changed the planet with endless immigration, multi-layered, multicolored, neither good nor evil, but a history of mankind.
Whoa.
Did you like it?
Oh, I am right now filled with language, sperm, and culture, listening to the poetry of Irene Bakalanik. I want to thank you. So it has been absolutely marvelous and delightful to have you in the neighborhood. I wish you much continued success with the publication of Rueful Reflections, which people can get on Amazon. When do you think you'll have book two ready for people to read and buy?
The rate I'm going, I would say in about 3 weeks.
Oh my God, wow, okay.
It's all there. It's just a matter of going through it all and posting it. But I thank you for this, Rabbi. This really has been great fun. I've enjoyed it.
Well, me too. And of course, even though you are an agnostic, I will thank you and wish you shalom.
Thank you. Shalom. Rome to you. By the way, one last thing I should tell you.
Please.
Besides being a writer-editor for the Jewish Post and Opinion, I wrote for an Israeli website.
Yay! What was it called?
All About Jewish Theater was his website.
Ooh.
Sandak, his name was Sandak.
Does that website still exist? Can people read your older pieces there?
I would think so.
Mazel. You made me even happier. Not only have you been an expert in Jewish theater, but you've written for Jewish websites and Israeli websites, too. So, again, you maybe you don't believe so much in God, but you still fill me with nachas, Irene Bakalanik.
Thank you.
Shalom again.
Shalom.